The daily podcast of The Exchange is supported by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. More information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Last night, NHPR held its annual State of the Newsroom, a celebration with supporters and board members of accomplishments over the past year. The event was headlined by a special guest, Jarl Mohn, the new CEO and president of NPR. Mohn came to the public radio network from a long career in broadcasting. He's best known for his work in TV, outlets like MTV and VH1 and E! Entertainment Television. And up until just recently, Mohn had been happily and successfully running his own business in Los Angeles while serving on the board of his local public radio station, KPCC. But Mohn became concerned over continued reports of transition at the top at NPR. Leaders seemed to keep coming and going. And when the latest CEO suddenly left after less than 2 years on the job to take another position, Mohn thought he could make a difference. And so, as he put it last night, I begged for that job, and he got it. Jarl Mohn took over at NPR in July. Since then, he's been spending lots of time on the road, visiting member stations and presenting his vision for the public radio system's future. Today in The Exchange, Jarl Mohn is here with us, and let's hear from you, too. It's your chance to talk with the new head of the public radio network that you listen to. So give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And you're all nice to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Of course. Good morning.
Well, last night you told us that you didn't even have a radio or a TV in your house growing up. There was more than one chuckle in the audience when you said your dad was an English professor. He wanted you to read books. And here you've made a career working in radio, working in TV. What drew you to broadcasting, Jarl, and what keeps you there?
It must have been the ultimate sign of rebellion, right? when I first became exposed to radio and TV, and I suppose it had to do with the fact that I wasn't allowed to watch it or listen to it, it was fascinating to me, and it still fascinates me today.
What was it that fascinated you about it?
Well, probably every aspect of it. At that point, when I first became exposed to it, I was probably 13 or 14, and it was rock and roll radio, which is how I began my career, what I started doing first. But then as I became exposed to other things, like when the cable industry grew, that was very interesting to me. Just people inventing new forms of communication, new forms of media, and I just wanted to be a part of it. Starting back then, and every time there's been a different iteration, that I got involved with public radio in Los Angeles, and I'd always listened to public radio and liked it, but I couldn't say I was a deep student of it until I was on the board, and then I went, wow. This is even better than I thought it was. This is great. I want to do this.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that you always listen to public radio because, and pardon me, but the image is of MTV and VH1 and E! Entertainment, you know, whiz, bang, pop culture, fireworks. That's not the image of NPR.
No, well, but they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. You can, one of the things we know from all the research we've done at, you know, for instance, at E, we would do focus groups, and we thought that that's what all these people liked. But quite frequently, people would come. They would say, they were professionals. I get home from work. I'm a lawyer. I'm a businessman. I just want to turn on the television and relax for a little bit and veg out. So they'll listen to news. They'll listen to public radio, NPR, and then they'll watch, you know, a trashy comedy.
So the two are not mutually exclusive.
I don't think so. Well, we're all very multidimensional people.
Right. Exactly.
All of us.
Well, when you did take this job, Jarl, there was some concern that your commercial TV sort of pop culture background wouldn't translate to public broadcasting and its mission. How did you address those concerns, Jarl?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We expected that that would be a concern. It actually was not. And I think a lot of that was addressed by the fact that I spent 12 years in public radio in L.A., on the board of trustees there, and the last 3 years as chairman. In addition to that, I spent 8 years on the board of the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at USC, and I think 3 or 4 years there as chairman. We expected that to be an issue. Never came up. Not once.
What do you think public media might learn from commercial media?
Well, I think the underlying lesson, the one that I think I bring, And I'm sure there are many other lessons, and I think it works the other way as well, that what commercial media can learn from public media. But I think the largest message is to really understand our audience as best we can. Commercial media, I think, typically does a very good job of understanding who their audience is, an individual channel, say, or an individual magazine. Public radio, I think, understands it and does a fair amount of research. I'm not sure a lot of that is applied, as much of it is applied as should be the case.
Wow. So give me an example, because I'm not familiar with commercial broadcasting. How deeply and richly do they know their audiences compared to what we know about our audiences here in public media? And why does that matter?
Well, it matters because we want to do as good a job as we can. We want to serve the audience. And in public radio, it's a public service mission. It's not a profit mission, as it might be in commercial radio or commercial television. And you know, mine are only anecdotes, but I was really surprised. One of the surprises I've had coming into NPR was I would bring up a particular point in a meeting. Why don't we do X, say? And somebody says, oh, you know, we did a study on that 4 years ago. And I go, really? Could I see that? And I read the study, and it's a terrific study. And I go, how come we never did this? Well, you know, there was turnover. We didn't have the budget. This happened. There were a litany of excuses why things didn't happen. So my sense is that we actually do know the audience. We do a lot of research. I think a lot of things, for whatever reason, have just maybe sometimes inertia, sometimes a little more difficult to implement. They haven't happened.
Well, and you mentioned the turnover, Jarl, and you are the fifth acting or permanent CEO in 5 years at National Public Radio. How do you think that all this transition has affected the institution?
It's affected it horribly, I think. The good news is it's an amazingly resilient place with amazingly resilient and really smart, committed people. And they've continued to do their jobs and really do their jobs extraordinarily well. But I think it's hurt the institution in that there hasn't been a continuum of leadership to make sure that initiatives that began were continued and completed. That said, the journalism is as good as, if not better, than it has ever been. The reach of the network and the public radio station system has never been as great as it is right now. I think, on radio broadcasting, it's over 30 million people a week, and online, over 31 million. So can't complain about that part.
And you've signed on for 5 years, from what
minimum,
I understand.
Minimum. I always stress the minimum. I said, I'll do it longer if it's fun.
Our phone number for you to join our conversation with Jarl Mohn. He's the new CEO and president of NPR, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. It's your chance to talk with Jarl Mohn. Again, he's the new head of the public radio network that you listen to, NPR. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from John in Nashua who says, given the results from the recent midterms, do you anticipate any changes in how much the U.S. government funds public radio? John, thanks for the question. Let's back up a little bit, though, Jarl, if we could, before we answer John's question. Just remind us of how this whole public radio ecosystem works, including that small federal funding piece.
Well, public radio gets funded in a number of ways. The pledge drives that people love so much. underwriting from local sponsors. And nationally, it's corporate underwriting. We have foundations. We have individual gifts from people. And for public radio, for NPR, there is a very small percentage of our budget that comes from the federal government. Local stations get some are university financed. So there might be money from the university, from the state government. Each public radio station really has kind of a slightly different mix.
And here at NHPR, just to clarify, we have no ties to the state or the university system. We're independent. We get about 6% of our funding from that CPB. But go ahead.
From the CPB, 6%. And I think NPR's number is around 3%. Anyway, that's the backdrop to it. The question is, do I think that the change in Congress is going to affect the funding? I hope it doesn't. I don't think it will. And the reason I don't is I think there is becoming more and more of an understanding across the board what a unique place public radio has in the dialogue with the American public. And so many sources of information on cable news are very ideological, either to the left or to the right. And most people on the Hill really do see public radio and NPR as an unbiased, fact-based source of journalism. And they know that's important. And they know that's it's a way for them to be able to get out their message, in a context where people aren't going to be argumentative or confrontational with them. So I'm cautiously optimistic that things are going to be good. I think people, government, really sees the value of public radio.
Two questions following up on that, Jarl. One is that you said that, sort of Fox News is said to have the news of the right, and MSNBC is said to have the news of the left. And a lot of people think NPR comes from the left as well. You were asked about that last night.
Yes. Well, I think that might have to do with, a legacy. And I haven't studied the history of NPR as much as I probably should have, going back, say, 40 years to what it might have been at that point or the roots. But it's not that way today. And I think anyone, the handful of people that do criticize us as perhaps being left or slightly left, are not generally people that listen to us. When you look at the composition of our audience, this is a fascinating fact, and I didn't mention this one last night. It's roughly a third, a third, a third. A third Democrats, a third, or people that describe themselves as liberal or Democrats, a third that describe themselves as conservative, and a third that describe themselves as independent. Now, it's not exactly that. It tends to skew slightly more toward the Democratic side, but it's roughly a third, a third, a third. That gets to, I think, the kind of journalism we do. Most of the people that are critical are people that have not spent any time listening. I always give them a challenge. Listen to 2 hours of our programming. If you hear something you think is unbiased or biased in some fashion, let me know. Call me. And no one has.
Yeah, you told us last night. You hand out your business cards and give people that little challenge.
Yeah. You think I should put my real phone number on there?
By the way, our phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. John, thank you for that email. We'll take more of your questions and comments in just a moment, and more conversation with Jarl Mohn, President and CEO of NPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with NPR's new president and CEO, Jarl Mohn. He's in New Hampshire this week, helping NHPR celebrate its annual State of the Newsroom. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, kudos, critiques of NPR programming are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Jarl, before we go back to our listeners, a couple more questions about your vision for public media, for NPR. Again, you just came to the job. If you could give me sort of your one or two big goals in this job, what would they be?
Well, the biggest thing, we chatted about this a little bit. I think the work and the journalism that's being done, not just at NPR, but across the board, across the system, including great places like here in New Hampshire and NHPR, the journalism is terrific, I think. Could it be better? Yeah, we could always do more. We can always do better. But it's really remarkably good. The business side of the business hasn't been good. My job is, I think, to right the ship. It's been an organization that's losing money for most of the last 6 or 7 years, somewhere in the area of $7 million a year.
Which may have something to do with all that transition at the top that you talked about.
I think there's that. I think there hasn't been the focus of, running it in a financially disciplined way. I think the lack of recognition or the lack of willingness or inability to take advantage. We have this wonderful audience, the people that are listening right now, well-educated, people that are deeply engaged in their communities. They want to know what's going on. They're curious. They're interested. And there's so many organizations or brands that want to associate or be able to reach those people. And we haven't done a good job of doing that. We haven't done a good job of getting the people that listen to support. You talk about the average public radio station, 10% of the people that listen are members. It's outrageous. 90% do not in any way financially support their station. That's wrong. There's a great opportunity to improve that. There's a great opportunity to improve foundations that have a mission for educating or having people engage civically. There are so many different ways that we can reach out and do a better job on the financial side of the business so that we can not just do the kind of journalism that we're doing today, but we can do better.
Well, and in an interview with KPCC before you left to come take the job, you said you felt lucky in this venture, unlike others that you've undertaken. You said there's no problem with NPR's product. You said it was spectacular. But you did go on to say, Jarl, that it's the business part of the business that needs help, just what you're saying to us now. So what changes do you envision taking to change this business end?
Well, there are a number of things. I just think the fundraising, we've been very modest in terms of, as a national organization, as a national entity, of going out and raising money from individuals. And I'm not talking about the on-air pledge drives, although that's because...
And we'll talk about that in a moment.
Okay. But in terms of people that love, the highest net worth people in the country, most of them, I don't have any surveys in front of me to prove this, I bet you that over 85% of them love public radio. You know, we had this wonderful gift, this legacy gift, a number of years ago from the Joan Kroc estate, $250
yes,
million. Dollars.
Yeah.
It was transformative. It was remarkable. Is Joan Kroc the only high net worth individual in the United States that's got the capacity to give a kind of gift like that, that loves public radio or NPR? I don't think so. We just haven't done a good job thinking about that or asking. We've been very modest. We need to be prouder of what we do and be more comfortable asking. And that's a huge part of what we're going to do.
Instead of saying, gee, I don't want to bother you.
Right.
Could you maybe consider? You're
exactly.
Saying, be a little bolder.
Exactly. It's good. It's no one's hit me yet. No one's thrown me out of their office yet. I suppose it'll happen at some point. But I'm very proud and I'm really of what this organization is. I didn't build it. I'm just a supporter of it. And I think it's a national treasure. And I think in communities around the country, the local treasures, what you folks have built here at NHPR, same thing. We have to be very proud of what we've done and what the value is in the community. And we have not communicated that, in my view.
Let's go to our listeners and see what they think. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Lou is calling from Concord. Hi, Lou. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
My question, with the loss of most of our daily papers all across the country, it's a real blow to the communities. What can NPR do to fill this hole beyond what it's doing now?
Okay. Lou, thank you very much. And, you know, y'all, you talked about this last night, the devastation of the print news business. You mentioned that your brother-in-law works for The New York Times.
Yep.
Big cutbacks there. So if you could address Lou's question, how we learn from what's happening in print and not get caught up in the same time.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is it's one of the reasons why public radio, in my view, is so important, and particularly locally. Because as small newspapers go away, community newspapers go away, or they get cut back or they shrink, the coverage in so many parts of the country has really been cut back. Public radio has picked up the slack in so many communities and has increased the journalism and has increased the coverage, and that's why it's really important. You know, nationally, you know, you're going to have the New York Times, although the Wall Street Journal, these are big newspapers, they're doing a remarkable job. Even the New York Times, as we spoke about last night, they just announced, I guess a few weeks ago, they're going to lay off another 100 people. All of them, I believe, are from the newsroom.
Wow, that's amazing.
And it's kind of sad. But, you know, they're going to survive because they do reach a lot of people. They will ultimately, I believe, figure out the business model. I'm more worried about local newspapers and smaller communities. I don't even mean small cities. I mean, urban areas, most urban areas, Detroit, Nashville, Tennessee. these cities have got to have vibrant newspapers or vibrant sources of information. And again, that's one of the things that I think public radio is picking up the slack on.
What do you think has led to this downslide of print? And I know, again, you're not a print guy, but you've obviously thought about it. This, you know, we talk about digital disruption and so forth, that print didn't quite adapt to the new digital realities quickly enough or well enough. But gosh, we've been in this era for a while now. So what's going on?
Well, a lot of things happened. I was tangentially involved in the newspaper business. I was on the board of the E.W. Scripps Company for years. I was on that board because of my expertise in cable networks. But they owned a lot of newspapers. And I watched as a lot of newspapers in smaller communities that they owned either had to be sold or shut down. And it was really depressing. A number of things happened. The first, we don't need to get into the forensics of the newspaper business and put everybody to sleep here, but the biggest piece was the classifieds, you know, which was the huge underpinning of the newspaper business went away because that business went online.
Right.
There was a statistic. One of our colleagues on the Scripps board, you know, ran the Toronto Star for years, and he said they did a survey, and it was 40 or 50 years ago. 70% of 70-year-olds were reading the newspaper, and when they were 30, 70% of them read the newspaper. 60% of 60-year-olds read the newspaper, and when they were 30, 60% of them read. And it went all the way down. So at that particular point, it was around 30% of 30-year-olds were reading the newspaper. It's not a good trend line for the business. But they're reaching a lot of people online. They just have not figured out how to monetize it. How do the paywalls work? I'm a New York Times subscriber. When I go to use it digitally, it makes me insane. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to get an article or not. You know, have I paid? Have I signed up for my digital subscription?
What the heck is my password?
I know. It's like it's crazy. They make it so hard. And I'm a fan. And I want it. And
right.
I'm paying for it. It shouldn't be that complicated. I think that'll be figured out. I really do.
How do you think local stations like this one can avoid, again, getting caught up in this wave? You addressed it a little bit, but I'd love to hear a little more.
On the digital side?
Yeah, sort of be overly disrupted by digital disruption.
You have to embrace it. You have to embrace it. And it's not one or the other. I think there is this mindset in the business, particularly in public radio, that you have to be radio, terrestrial radio, or you have to be in digital. I think you have to do both. They're both going to be – I really believe radio is going to be around for a long time. I cite one of the stations I was visiting 2 weeks ago in San Diego. Great radio station, KPBS. They happen to be a joint licensee, so they have a PBS television affiliate as well. What they've done, they do three things well, and they've done three things for many years. And I tell every station I go into, if you do these three things over the long term, you're going to do okay. They invested a lot of money in local journalism. Okay, they have a remarkable team there, including an investigative team. The second thing they've done is they've made sure that all of the things that they produce are on every platform. They put it on the television station. They have a local news show they do on their TV affiliate. If somebody's on the TV station, they take that content and they put it on the radio. They're on Facebook. They're on Twitter. You know, they're on every possible platform. I'm sitting there in the staff meeting talking to the staff, and they're tweeting some of my quotes.
And you said, wait.
Yeah, I just started editing myself a little bit. But they've done that. And the third thing is they've really embraced the co-branding with us, making sure that people say that it's local, it's KPBS, and for national and international, it's NPR. And they've embraced the co-branding. Those three things are, in my view, the things that really work for local radio. And those stations that do that and invest in it and do it consistently over time are going to really do well across all of these platforms.
Let's take some more calls. Jarl, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Rick's in Manchester. Hi, Rick. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Good morning, Jarl.
Good morning. Good. Thank you.
Long time listener, Laura. I've got a question for Jarl. I'm a sustaining member of NHPR, and I was just wondering, will there ever come a day when there are enough sustaining members to end pledge drives altogether?
Rick, that's a question.
I love pledge drives, but yeah.
It's a question we get often. Thank you so much for calling in. Go ahead, Jarl.
What, do you want to put the tote bag business out of business?
The mug business.
The mug business. It's a great question. And I think it's a sensitive one for a lot of people that have been long-time listeners and long-time supporters of public radio. It is a clunky system. No one has, to date, come up with a better methodology. And clearly, if only 10% of the people that listen are actually supporting the stations, that's not a good one. But that's the best there is. I was telling Laura earlier that a couple of stations, I think the first one to do it was KQED in San Francisco. I was just there a month ago. They had their pledge drive. I was on the local talk show at KQED. While the pledge drive was on, if you are a sustaining member, they give you a password, and you can go online and listen to the station without the pledge drive. I think it's remarkable. And then the station I was involved with, KPCC, just experimented with it the first time. Not a lot of people are signing up for it yet, but I think there's something there. If you imagine ultimately having a mobile device as we start to transition, listening to the station streaming, but perhaps maybe on another device. Maybe it's a mobile device. Maybe it's your laptop. Being able to avoid the pledge drive totally.
A pledge-free stream.
Yeah, but you have to be a sustaining member.
Right, yeah. Right. You've paid up. And that's the complaint that I hear from people. You know, they complain about the pledge drive, and I say, well, we need to do it because not enough listeners contribute. And they say, but I contribute faithfully. Can't you give me a pledge-free stream? And I say, well, no, we don't really have
It's really
that.
Amazing. 126% of the people say they've actually joined.
Well, I do wonder how that would work in the long run, though, Jarl. I can kind of picture, you know, one person giving and sharing the password with five of their friends.
It could look.
There's probably technical ways around it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that happens. And I'm sure it could happen. I just think it's an interesting experiment. We have to innovate. We have to try different things because I don't think there's anyone on the planet, well, maybe, that thinks that is the best way of doing it.
Well, Rick, thank you for that comment. And that's real interesting. I had not heard about that example until today. So thanks, Rick, for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. In Alton, Chris is waiting. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Oh, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
it's all well and good. I think I support NPR. And there's one thing that was a comment about not being biased or not being, say, a liberal media outlet, and that's just totally unrealistic. I mean, 17 of the 18 commentators on NPR National are liberals. 17 out of 18. I mean, your most conservative voice is David Brooks. I mean, that's just tone deaf if you think that that's like somewhere in the middle. I mean, it's a liberal outlet. That's fine. I mean, but we should be honest about it. It's almost like Gruberism where you say, well, people just can't realize this.
Chris, thanks
and
for
coming in. We go through one, and you know, it's so ingrained, it's so, you just take it for granted. I don't mind it, but
you feel it's there. Well, thanks for calling in. What do you think, Jarl? The commentators, he says the most conservative voice you have is David Brooks, who's, you know, pretty moderate.
Yeah, well, I have heard that from conservatives. But let's talk about the news coverage first. We're not talking about commentary. The newscasts, the reporting, I believe completely is unbiased. We do have people that come on to comment from time to time about the news and debate the pros and the cons, the left and the right. I don't know where the 17 out of 18 commentators comes from. I've never heard that stat. I don't know it. Should we have more conservative voices on the air or voices that are more conservative than David Brooks? The answer is yes. And we have. A few weeks ago, we had, I can't remember her name. She was from The Blaze. That's about as conservative as you can get. He's not the only conservative voice that's heard on NPR. That's just wrong. Should we have more or different or more conservative voices on? Of course we should. And we're working in that area. But I want to get back to—
You are working in that area.
Yes, because we want to do that. But the point I really want to stress, let's not confuse having a debate or commentary between, you know, a liberal and a conservative point of view about any particular topic and what kind of news coverage we have.
I think it is interesting, though, because people listen to a show like All Things Considered, and they may say, oh, that was a great news piece that so-and-so reported on from Capitol Hill or from London or wherever. But if you follow up with a liberal commentator, and then maybe the next hour there's another commentator who's sort of moderate to liberal, people put it in a package. So maybe the reporters are impeccable, but they hear the whole package, and they get the impression that Chris gets.
Yeah, again, one of the things I shared with Laura, the research shows that we're about a third. If we do have a bias of some sort, I don't think it would be wildly one way or the other, because I don't think we'd have that kind of distribution.
Well, Chris, thank you for calling in. And this is a question that came up last night at our event as well. Here's Liz in Londonderry, an email. This is the other side from what Chris feels. Liz says, I'd like Mr. Moan to know that the exchange is so good at keeping partisanship out of the show that I can never even guess how our host, Laura Kanoy, votes, although I promise you, Liz, I do vote. Liz says, talk radio without bias opens the channels for communication the way it should be. Liz says, thanks, Laura. And Liz, thanks right back at you. There we have it. Some people hear bias and some people don't.
And I think a lot of it has to do with the way, hosts do their job. We have a host in L.A., Larry Mantle on KPCC. I listened to Larry for years. He's a great interviewer. I never knew his politics, and one day someone told me what they were. I've been listening to him for 10 years, and I was absolutely startled, because I had no idea. And I listened to him every day for 10 years.
Chris, thank you for your comments. Liz, thank you for your email. We'll take more of your questions, comments, and concerns. It's a great opportunity for you to chime in with Jarl Moan. Again, he's the brand new CEO and president of NPR. He's in New Hampshire, taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email like Liz did, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back in just a moment more with Jarl Moan on the future of NPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, ballot measures in other states in the midterm elections and New Hampshire's ballot selfie debate. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Join us for that. Today, we're talking with Jarl Moan. He's NPR's new president and CEO. He's in New Hampshire this week, and you can join us. Your questions, comments, critiques, kudos for Mr. Moan and NPR are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Jarl, let's go back to our listeners. Ken's joining us from Hampton. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason I'm calling, Laura, is twofold. I think you're one of the best talk show hosts going, and congratulations. And I wanted the president of NPR to share that. You're well-known, even in Maine. Maine, I think, wanted to get you at one time. But the reason I'm calling is I'd like to look at the other end of it. You know, if you've been in the hole going 7% per year, I've gone online and you can check online for the income tax returns. And I've seen things that are just, they blow my mind as a person with a lot of cups and a lot of tote bags. The parachute, for example, of your successor after the brouhaha with Juan Williams and the $5 million Middle East advertising scandal, she got $600,000 as a golden parachute.
And you're talking about NPR now, Ken.
NPR.
Yeah. After National the whole Juan Williams thing. Right.
Right. And also, if you go online, you can see the salaries that we're paying some of the people for Morning Edition and Weekend Edition and All Things Considered. They're more than the presidents. They're getting $460,000 a year, including the bonuses.
So is there a way to?
Show.
Yeah.
You have a great 1 hour show, and you're talking all the time. They have other people and so forth.
Point. Thank you so much for calling in. And, he's gone online, y'all. He's looked at some of the salaries and some of the payouts after some of the turmoil a couple of years ago. And he's saying, hey, somebody who's bought a lot of tote bags and NPR cups. And thank you, Ken, for your support. He's a little concerned.
Sure. Well, first, relative to some of the severance payments, that particular CEO did have a contract, and that contract specified severance payments. I was not responsible for that, but that was an agreement, and most executives would have a contract that pays them severance if they're fired. I would tell you, my contract is a 5-year contract. I've committed for a minimum of 5 years. There is no severance agreement in my contract at all, by my request. So if they decide one morning that or one afternoon that they don't want me to work there anymore, there's no compensation. I've done that because I don't have the need for that. I've done well in my life. I've been very fortunate. And so this, for me, is a mission, and I can afford to do it. Not everybody can. As it comes to talent, you know, it is a marketplace. Even though it's not a commercial marketplace, it is a marketplace. There are many very successful public radio stations around the country that have great talent like yourself. And in large markets, they pay, you know, competitive salaries, not as competitive as, say, the commercial stations. But our talent does get recruited from time to time from, you know, network, commercial networks. Most of the people choose not to take the big salaries because they really are committed to public radio. But the numbers that they're being paid, while significantly less than they could be making commercially, is kind of the balance. It's the equilibrium. What does it take to keep them from going to commercial? But at the same time, try to understand the kind of financial constraints that we're under in public broadcasting.
Yeah, this does come up in the nonprofit world, and I've seen this in other nonprofit organizations, big nonprofits like NPR. And there is a tricky sensibility, I think, Jarl, where you want to attract great talent. At the same time, you are a nonprofit. You are getting tax breaks. You are having people like Ken donate, you know, whatever they can. So it's tough.
Yeah, well, it is a bit of an equilibrium. We think the fact that we are able to keep really terrific people at prices or wages or salaries that are materially under what the commercial world pays says that we've kind of hit the right balance.
Okay. Well, Ken, thank you very much for calling in. Good to hear from you. And Christina joins us from Concord. Hi, Christina. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for listening. Public radio is very important to me. I actually have a cleaning business, and I listen to you all day while I'm working. But my point is, the way public radio is so different from commercial is exactly the fact that we don't cater to our listeners. Something you mentioned very early on when you came on was finding out who your audience is, and then fulfilling what they're looking for directly. And my favorite part about public radio is that they don't tell us what we want to hear. They tell us what we wouldn't have thought of on our own. And I think it's so much of what's out there in every other media source is they're trying to, like, by the minute, follow what are people interested in, what do they want to, you know, us to pay attention to. And the thing about public radio, regardless of whether you're conservative or liberal or whatever, is the ability to trust that they're going to tell us not what we want to know, but what we need to know, and stuff that we never would have thought of on our own.
Christina,
so thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, and it's great that you're listening so much. This is a really important point. Telling people not necessarily that they want to know. You know, I remember when Michael Jackson died, for example, there was sort of wall-to-wall coverage on commercial media about that, and NPR did some coverage too, and we got some criticism of too much Michael Jackson. On the other hand, people were really interested in that story, especially people of my generation who grew up with Michael Jackson. Yeah. So I do wonder about Christina's point. It's kind of a profound one. You do want to cover what people are interested in.
Well, the difference, to reframe it a bit, I agree with what she is saying. If all we did research to try to understand what kind of stories do people want, let's just do those and let's not do these other over here, we wouldn't be public radio. We wouldn't sound the way we do. She's right. She's absolutely right. When I talk about understanding the audience, it's understanding people like her and what she just said.
About what she likes about
public radio. It's not about minute by minute saying, does this story work or does this story not? It's understanding that most people, us really understanding the audience, like her, that want those moments of surprise. And the other part of what we do, I think, and I hope we do well, what we try to do well, is take a story that is a tough story that's hard to tell. And my favorite example of this is when the subprime mortgage meltdown occurred, Planet Money did 2 hours, the big pool of money, 2 hours on a very important story, really important story, but a hard story to tell and kind of boring. If you read it, it could be a very boring story. And it was retold through the voices of the people, a guy that got a loan that should never have gotten a loan. Then it was daisy chained up, the guy who sold him the loan, all the way up to the investment banks and the hedge funds and the various tranches.
Which is fascinating.
That story was important. If we had done a piece of research, should we do stories about the subprime mortgage meltdown? The answer would be no, don't. But our listeners want to know what's going on in the world, broadly speaking. So when I talk about understanding the audience, that's what I mean.
And people still talk to me about that piece. They say it was amazing.
Yeah, it was a great. It was two 1-hour specials.
And fascinating about something that could be, again, deathly dull.
Right.
All right. Well, Christina, thank you for calling in. You know, I did want to ask you, Jarl, lots of comments from our listeners, but I did want to take a moment to ask you about foreign coverage, because mm-hmm. that is an area where NPR has been beefing up its coverage at a time when other news organizations, many of them, have been reducing their footprint overseas. You guys have been expanding it. Even though it's expensive, you mentioned last night a new bureau in South Korea that's opening up. The question I want to ask you, though, Jarl, is here in New Hampshire especially, there's been lots of attention to protecting journalists in war zones. James Foley, a New Hampshire native, was terribly murdered by ISIS, as we all know. Stephen Sotloff went to private school here, again, brutally murdered. And people here in New Hampshire especially are just really feeling the pain of this. What are the protocols for protecting NPR journalists in war zones, Jarl?
It's probably the single biggest worry that any of us have. We have 17 bureaus now internationally. We're going to 18. We care deeply about our correspondents. The first thing we do is to make sure that they're not going anywhere or doing anything that they don't want to do. Our biggest challenge is trying to talk them out of things. They're journalists. They care.
They want to go in.
They want to go in. We go, whoa, pump the brakes. Pump the brakes. We have to – our biggest job there is to discourage them from going too far, because as very interested and committed journalists, they want to get in there. So we have to train them about what not to do in many cases. We have a security guy, a fabulous guy, a Brit named David Hawley. He was a former British Royal Marine. He was a commando. He used to do this job for the BBC. He does it for us now. And he is the one that puts them through training. We have a hostile environment training program every 2 to 3 years for people that are in hot zones. Many of them carry a tracking device, a satellite tracking device the size of a credit card, so we know where they are at all times. Many of the bureaus where there are conflicts, particularly now the Middle East or Ukraine, they have to wear body armor and helmets. They have to report in there's a protocol for reporting in, so we know where they are at all times. We have a protocol for Ebola and for our reporters.
A reporter heading over here now.
Kelly McGovern is going over right now, and we just spoke before she took off. We do everything we can. We try to, and in spite of that, so much of it is out of our control. We can only do so much, but we try to encourage them to understand what the risks are, and not do anything. Not to go too far and not to take any unnecessary risks.
I asked you this last night, Jarl, but I want to ask you again. Given that the U.S. seems to be, again, stepping up its military involvement in Iraq and Syria, and we don't know how far that's going to go, but clearly this country is doing more over there. Do you plan to send more people into those hotspots?
Wherever there is something going on that matters in the world, that people care about, that's newsworthy, we will have our people there. That's our mission. It's tough. It's a tough decision because it's putting them in harm's way. We only send people that want to go. These are it's a really unique group of people.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, it's when you talk to them, you find out they are there for a purpose. And we try to equip them as best we can. Thankfully, there are only one or two spots at a time, or three, and all 18. We're not taxing all 18 bureaus at the same time, so we will move people around. But if something is heating up in an area, our people are going to be there.
What about the model, Jarl, of training and hiring local people, Syrians and Iraqis, who may be accomplished journalists and might have a better a better ability to move among the local public and get their real story.
Mm-hmm. It's good to have them as sources. The difficulty we have is because we have to stand by our journalism. And you know from your own experience here, and the conversation that occurred last night, the kind of vetting and fact checking we do before we put anything on the air. In any territory, and it doesn't have to be international, it could be domestic as well, we have to make sure that our sources and, you know, the journalism is right on the mark. So every time we bring in somebody from the outside, we get access to certain information, but it makes our job of fact-checking that much more difficult.
Mm. All right. Well, let's close out with a couple emails if we could, Jarl. And here's one from John in Goffstown. He says, why do there have to be so many station or program identification breaks? So often it cuts guests' comments off before they're done speaking. Even on Laura's show, I would guess there's a good 10 minutes of show identification, station identification, contact information, show lead-in. John says, it kills me. Thank you, John, for the comment. This gets to what we talked about earlier, Jarl, a concern of a so-called creeping commercialism, that there's too many commercial breaks and station ID breaks. What do you think?
Well, it gets back to what's the sustainable business model. This is a really important service, I think, public service that NPR provides nationally and NHPR provides locally and a lot of stations provide locally. We are lucky in that we have a number of different ways that we can finance this, whether it's listener donations, whether it's corporate underwriting, whether it's some government money, although it's very, very little. But when you add up and when you think about what we do in terms of how much is there, I doubt that it's 10 minutes. I think it's a lot less than that. And you compare it to what you get on commercial outlets, it is dramatically different. The quality is infinitely better, and the amount of messaging, and I don't call it commercialism. It's some people might feel it's that way, but these are organizations that are supporting us. We don't do prices. We don't do specials. We don't do comparisons. We don't do any of that stuff. When you compare the amount of those mentions compared to a commercial outlet is dramatically less, and the quality is infinitely better. So I think it's a great value proposition.
Well, John, I appreciate the comment for sure. As the one who has to kind of manage the conversation and then, oops, it's time for a break. But we try to make it work for you, and I'm glad that you're a listener, John. You know, Jarl, just to close out with you, as I said, you were chosen for this job in May. You started in July. What's it been like for you to move from that sort of Los Angeles, California lifestyle to the more sober, buttoned-down Washington, D.C., the Beltway?
My wife goes, what were you thinking?
It's nice in L.A.
It's beautiful in L.A. The biggest stress I had every day was, do I ride my mountain bike or do I ride my road bike? That was the biggest stress I've had. so that's been different. But, you know, and as much as I was having fun in doing venture investing in early-stage companies, I really I wasn't driven by a mission, and I knew for years that I wanted to do something. I didn't know what it was. I went to a conference. Elon Musk was speaking about creating Tesla, and the outcome, most likely outcome, was failure. He talked about SpaceX, and the most likely outcome was failure. Somebody asked him about digital media on the panels. Walter Mossberg, who was then at the Wall Street Journal, and he said, "What's your impression of digital media today? What do you think?" And Musk was thinking and thinking. It seemed like an eternity of silence as he was thinking about this. And he said, I've never seen so many great minds working on such small things. And I was like, wow. And at that moment, I said, you know something? I'm having a ball, but I got to do something. I got to do something. And this is it. And I'm enjoying this immensely.
Well, it's really fun to meet you.
Same here.
And I hope
you make
back.
A mean cup of coffee.
I made you my special blend.
Woo!
And no one at the station likes it but you. So
I love it.
I really appreciate you saying that. Jarl Mohn, it's really fun to meet you, and I'm sure we'll see you again.
Yes.
All right. That's Jarl Mohn again. He's president and CEO of NPR. He joined the network just this past July. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern, Joanna Albertson-Grove. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.